It's a great pleasure to be talking to Les Hyatt, a distinguished anthropologist of Australia. Les, where were you born and when?
Well, I was born in 1931 in a small country town in northwestern New South Wales called Gilgandra.
Can you tell us something about your parents?
My father was the son of English migrants. His father and his mother came from the West Country. His father from Gloucestershire and his mother from Devonshire. And his father became a flour miller in a town called Wellington in New South Wales, Western New South Wales. And my father followed him into the flour milling trade, not as a flour miller, but as a bookkeeper and ultimately the manager of the Gilgandra flour mill. My mother's parents were bakers, pastry cooks, and her father owned a pastry cook business in Gilgandra, and to which my father's mill sold the flour, and that's how my father presumably met my mother. We grew up in about three quarters of an acre of land on which the flour mill residence was situated, and it was rather like growing up on a small farm.
Did either of your parents have a strong influence on you, or both of them?
I wouldn't say that my parents had a strong intellectual influence upon me. They were concerned to do the best they could for their oldest son, that was me, who turned out to be a promising student at the Gilgandra School. And following the advice of the headmaster of the school, my father decided that he should make every effort to send me away to school in Sydney. I resisted this very strongly because I couldn't see anything wrong with Gilgandra. It's a small town of about 3,000 people in the wheat and sheep area, and all my friends, all my experience, life experience was there, and I tried to resist leaving Gilgandra in order to go to school. In the event, I left halfway through my high school at Gilgandra, and I went to an agricultural high school outside Sydney called Hurlston Agricultural High School, and that was the beginning of the end of my association with the part of New South Wales where I was born. I've really been back there since.
When you went to the school, were there any subjects which you began to gravitate towards, any topics or disciplines?
Well, I think the two things to say. One is that there was a continuation of my interest in English literature and humanities type subjects. I was never terribly strong at mathematics, In order to be at, in order to qualify for the matriculation, I had to do two subjects that were peculiar to the agricultural high school. It was agriculture and botany. And it seemed logical when I matriculated to enter Sydney University's Faculty of Agriculture. And I was quite happy about that, but my father was uncertain about agricultural science as a career. And he had, in the course of his work as a flour miller, he had the most important person that on the scientific side that he'd encountered was a man called Dr. McIndoe, who was head of the Department of Agriculture, and who agreed to speak to my father and to me about agricultural science as a career. And he effectively dissuaded us from thinking any further about that. And he thought that it was a dead end. He himself was a disaffected man. And he said to my father, a doctor or a dentist makes four times as much as I do. So I ended up doing dentistry at Sydney University. And I disliked it. I don't necessarily hold it against Dr. McIndoe, but I think I would have been. I think I would have been happy as an agricultural scientist, rather than as a practicing dentist, because I when I entered third year dentistry, we began to study subjects like pathology and bacteriology. And it wasn't that I was especially interested in the subject matter of either of these subjects, although I did. It did make me a lifelong hypochondriac, I must say. But what I was taken by was the notion of research. It was really the first time, given my boyhood in the bush, the lack of any precedence for university work and scientific work, I had not before considered research as a career, and I became fascinated with glass slides and pathological specimens, and when I graduated in dentistry, I seriously considered doing medicine, because in the hope that this might lead me to a career in medical research. Impossible in the circumstances, because my father had made sacrifices to put me through dentistry, and he didn't have the sort of money that would enable him to afford another 5 years in medicine. I suppose the next question that you would ask me is, how did I get from dentistry to anthropology?
Yes, indeed.
In the last 18 months of my dental undergraduate career, my father did find enough money to support me in one of the residential colleges at Sydney University, and that was the important turning point in my life, looking at it retrospectively, because there I met students in the Faculty of Arts. I became very friendly with a Sri Lankan student by the name of Lakshmi Jayasurya, who was...
how do you spell his name?
Lakshiri is his first name, Lakshiri, Jayasurya, Jayasurya.
Thank you.
Yeah. And he was the top student in psychology and anthropology at that time, and it was through him really that I gained some notion of what anthropology was about. And so when shall I continue with this this part of the story? By the time I graduated in dentistry in 1952, I was determined somehow to effect an exit from dentistry and to get into the Faculty of Arts, and I wanted to do psychology. Anthropology, I thought, too, would be interesting, but psychology and philosophy were the subjects that I'd become interested in. So the question was how to do this without asking my father for money that he didn't have. And I spent several weeks speaking to dentists in various suburbs in Sydney to see if they wanted a part-time assistant. And none of them did until I contacted a second cousin of my father who was a medico, and he introduced me to a colleague, a dental colleague, who said to me something like, "Well, I don't want an assistant. I certainly don't want to, I'm not prepared to pay you anything, but you are welcome to use my surgery at night after I've finished with it." So for the next 2 years, I built up a little practice from 5 o'clock until 8 o'clock at night, and went to lectures in philosophy and psychology in 1953, began anthropology in 1954. Anthropology at that time was a second year subject. After my first year of anthropology, and that's 2 years of arts, I decided that I was that I should take a year off, work as a dentist, and save up enough to do the last 2 years, including an honours degree, without working. So I got on a train and went to a country town called Bourke in Western New South Wales, and I worked there for a year as an assistant dentist. Got married, came back and finished my last two arts, including an honours degree in anthropology.
And you were taught, among others, by John Barnes, I gather.
Yes, my first teachers, and I should say that the department was very small at that time. My first teachers were A.P. Elkin, the professor, and Mervyn Maggott, who had recently joined the department. And they were both specialists in Australian Aboriginal studies, and there's no doubt that they were both important influences in my subsequent research career. Elkin retired, and let me see. Elkin retired. I'd been back in 1955. Mm. I came back 50, 50, yes. Elkin retired halfway through 56, and his chair was taken by, was offered to John Barnes, and John Barnes turned up towards the end of 1956.
Could you just say something about Elkin and maybe it just as people or academics, you know, a little, anything that you remember about them, because they're famous figures?
Yes, I'm. I guess I knew Elkin reasonably well. He wasn't an easy man to get to know. He was much older, of course, than I was, and so the relationship with him was that of student to master. And he was a reserved, somewhat aloof man, and I wouldn't want to say harsh things about him, but he was a somewhat self-important man, and so it wasn't terribly easy to approach him. And but I guess the harshest thing I would have to say about Elkin is that he was not a good lecturer, and in a subject like Aboriginal kinship, there has to be an acknowledgement that the student coming at the subject of such complexity for the first time is not an expert. And Elkin tended to speak to us as he would to perhaps to fellow experts. And his technique was to scribble kinship diagrams on a large blackboard to the point where the blackboard was unintelligible. And I really thought, and I think my colleague Michael Allen felt much the same way, that kinship was really going to be too hard for us. In any case, things took a different direction when John Barnes arrived. I went, of course, later on. I became totally immersed in Aboriginal kinship as a research worker, and to some extent, I think I came to understand and forgive Elkin for his. Perhaps his rather unsympathetic pedagogical style.
What about Mervyn Maggott?
Mervyn was a very different person from Elkin. He had served about 2 years, I think, in the Australian Navy, and he enlisted as a 17-year-old, and by the time he returned and had done and had matriculated, which he hadn't done by the, at the time of his enlistment, he was very much a man of the world. And in fact, one of the first things that we noticed about Mervyn, when he took his coat off and rolled up his sleeves, was that he had several tattoos on his arm, which he had acquired during his Navy years. And I engaged very quickly with Mervyn in a way that was impossible with A.P. Elkin.
And since we mentioned John Barnes, you've remained a friend with John for many years. Mm. What was he like as a new professor and teacher?
Well, he was a bit like a man from outer space, as far as we were concerned. And he seemed, I guess, very English, and he had a habit of raising his eyebrows rapidly, which were which was surprising and somewhat amusing. And I think John was, because John was finding his own feet in Australia, and we were his first students, it took a little time for us to work each other out. I remember thinking to myself, he's an odd fellow, John Barnes. I don't quite know what to make of him. And the lavatory near, closest to the anthropology department was down a set of steps, and I remember I was washing my hands in the toilet when John Barnes came in, and I went to the urinal and I heard him whistling, and then he started to sing a song called "Click Go the Shears." It was a very popular shearer song, and there'd been an upsurge of interest in Australian folk ballads and so on. So I was very impressed to hear John actually singing "Click Go the Shears" in the toilet near the anthropology department. And I thought, well, I guess he must be all right.
That's a very nice anecdote. You mentioned Michael Allen, who is an anthropologist as well. He's remained a friend as well. Is there anything you'd like to say about Michael?
Well, first of all, I'd want to say that he's one of my oldest and dearest friends in anthropology. He wasn't with me in first year anthropology. He came after I returned from this sojourn in Bourke, and he was doing anthropology 1 and 2 together in order to do an MA qualifying. He was already a BA, and there were just four of us in the honors class, and we went on to do the honors year together under John Barnes' new chairmanship of the department. And Michael and I then went on to the Australian National University simultaneously with John Barnes, who relinquished the chair of anthropology at Sydney University within 18 months of being there, and to take up the chair that was vacated by as a result of the death of Nardell. So Michael and I then did our PhD research at the same time, pretty much. He went to the New Hebrides, I went to Northern Australia, and we would see each other in the University House during breaks from fieldwork and so on. And I've never really lost contact with him. And just one thing I would add about Michael, before he went to the New Hebrides, he took a job in the Northern Territory administration as an assistant to the Director of Welfare. There was something of a martinet, a man with a very loud voice, and with a gift of terrorising his own staff and visitors and so on. So I faced the interview with this man with a certain amount of trepidation. And it would have been, but all went extremely well. I was expecting to be told that anthropologists were barely welcome in the Northern Territory, particularly as there had been some problems with Nancy Munn. Nancy Munn had worked in the desert, and it was considered by the administration that she had allowed herself to get too close to the Aboriginal community, actually wanting to live in the same part of the village with them, and things of that sort. But the director seemed to me to take a very kindly interest in what I was doing. I realized later that it was because of Michael Allen's preparatory work that I got off so lightly. I'm grateful to Michael for that.
Tell me about your first field work then. You went off to do your PhD. Do you remember that moment of arrival, which is often described by
I do indeed. I said that I came back from Bourke married, and my wife was before marriage was Betty Meehan. As an aside, I'll say that she later became very a very well known prehistorian.
How do you spell her name?
Meehan. And she wrote a very well known book called Shell Bed to Shell Midden. Betty and I spent some 6 weeks in Darwin, waiting for a supply ship to take us to this newly formed settlement called Maningrida in...
how is that spelled?
Maningrida. It's an anglicization of an Aboriginal word that I won't try and spell. we waited for this supply vessel for some 6 weeks in Darwin, and the ship couldn't be repaired, and we went out instead on a pearling lugger, captained by a man who had not been to Maningrida before. And we got lost on the way, overshot the mark by 100 miles, and we were late getting in into the mouth of the Liverpool River on which the settlement had been established, and it was quite dark, and I remember as we approached the beach seeing. Campfires all along the beach, and complement of staff and the Aboriginal community, some 350 Aborigines were in residence at that time, were assembled on the beach to not, I think, to greet us, but we felt as though that was what was happening. They were waiting for the supply ship. It was a marvellous experience. It's imprinted on my mind. We were rowed ashore in a dugout canoe, and an exotic scenario that greeted us.
Did you enjoy your field work?
It was the vindication of my decision to leave dentistry. Although I must say that when it became known that I was a trained dentist, and that I had actually brought a set of forceps that had been given to me, just in case I needed them. I did do some bush dentistry in the course of my fieldwork, but more generally, the circumstances were I'd say easy rather than difficult. The climate itself on the north coast was not nearly so difficult to come to terms with as a summer in Central Australia. It was in some ways it was idyllic, and we were helped by Aboriginal people to put up our tent, and a shade was constructed over the top of it. We were taken up, welcomed by the three Europeans who were on the staff, and we became very much part of the social life, such as it was, of the Europeans, and that of course caused the usual difficulties that anthropologists have to deal with. It was pleasant to become part of that small white community, but for obvious reasons, I didn't want to become so identified with it that I was seen to be part of the staff. And the Aborigines, for the first few months that I was there, thought that I was a patrol officer, and they couldn't understand. It took them a long time to understand, A, that I was not a patrol officer, and B, if I wasn't a patrol officer, what the hell was I doing there?
What were you doing there? What was your main questions that you were interested in?
I fortunately had done my BA honours thesis on the subject of conflict. I was inspired to do this partly by Mervyn Mickett and partly by John Barnes. Mervyn's thesis on the Walbury contained rich material on disputes, their causes and resolution. And John's contribution was to say, look, there really hasn't been any systematic work done on conflict in traditional Aboriginal Australia, and he introduced me to Gluckman's work and also to a book by Llewellyn and Hobel, Share and Way, and that's what I followed up in the field. I wanted to find out what people thought about, how disputes proceeded, how they were settled in the absence of any judicial machinery, in the absence of any political institutions, any of leadership.
What language did you work in?
Well, the language is best known as Burrara. That's spelled B-U-R-A-R-R-A. But I became identified with the largest segment of that language, which whose members spoke a language they referred to as Gidjingali, G-I-D-J-I-N-G-A-R-L-I, and they prefer to use that term. So I fluctuated a bit between Burrara and Gidjingali.
So after the field work, you came back, as is traditional, and wrote your PhD. Is that right?
Well, I did field work in two parts. I took a break in the middle, and with a total number of total period of about 20 months in the field. And yes, and I wrote that up partly under John Barnes' supervision, partly under Bill Stanner's supervision. Stanner was away on leave when I began the field work, and John Barnes supervised the work. He was very keen to, he was an extremely good supervisor, and would have been anyway, but I think that he was especially interested because it enabled him to get into Aboriginal ethnography, and as a result of which he wrote, I think, a very well-regarded paper on Northeast Arnhem Land kinship, the Mergen problem. And Stanner returned from the field and from leave, and it I I don't know what discussions took place between John Barnes and Bill Stanner. I would have been, I must say, I would have been very pleased if John had continued to be my supervisor, because we got on very well together, and he was most conscientious and very insightful. He probably felt that for diplomatic reasons that I should be transferred to Bill Stanner, and I've got no complaints about Bill Stanner either. In fact, the two men complemented each other in very important ways for me.
So, who were your examiners finally in your PhD?
Well, I had two examiners. One was Raymond Firth, and the other was Ian Hoban. And what I can't remember now is why I didn't have as an examiner somebody who was, you might say, an expert in the Aboriginal field. And it may have had something to do with the unavailability of people. There weren't so many anthropologists around in those days. Anyway, I've got no complaint about either of the two supervisors who did mark the thesis. They had both had very helpful comments to make, and within a couple of years, I'd published the thesis as a book called Kinship and Conflict.
Well, you got to know Raymond Firth quite well over the years. Is there anything you'd like to say about him? Do you remember any?
Raymond and Ian Hoban were very good friends. Ian, by that time, was, I'm talking now about the early 1960s, after I submitted my PhD thesis at the ANU, I took up a tutorship in the Sydney department. And by that time, the professor was Bill Geddes, and Ian Hoban was a reader, and I became very friendly with Ian. Ian had a circle of friends, some of them anthropologists, others part of, you might say, Sydney intelligentsia. And Ian became a sort of patron saint, as well as a friend for me. And he was a close friend of Raymond. Raymond was coming through Sydney, and Ian had a dinner party for him, and I was introduced to him. And we at just about that time, I'd been awarded an ANU travelling scholarship, which I could have taken up anywhere, more or less, but I. Having met Raymond Firth, I decided that the LSE would be a very good place to take it up, and so in 1964 I came to the LSE as the ANU travelling scholarship.
Watch out, drink. And that was about 3 years before I went to the LSE. Do you have any memories of the LSE in
1964? Well, Raymond was still very much in full flight, and I joined his graduate seminar, which was very large. There were a lot of Americans there. I remember that. This is very well known, so I won't spend much time on it. But Raymond was very much like the conductor of an orchestra. After the paper was given, he would then orchestrate the discussion, and I It was a style that I wasn't accustomed to, and in some ways I think I reacted against it. I felt that if I had something to say, I'd put up my hand and ask to say it. Fairly early in the piece, somebody gave a paper, and Raymond at a certain point said, "Well, we have the privilege having among us an expert on Aboriginal studies, Dr. Hyatt," and he went and looked around, and he invited me to make a comment on whatever the issue was, and it had nothing, as far as I could, to do with anything that I knew about. And I replied if not tersely, anyway, fairly parsimoniously, and I rather regretted that. I thought I was probably a bit rude. Anyway, Raymond didn't hold it against me. In fact, he was always very kind to me, and I continued to see him right up until a few months before he died.
Mm. So after that time at the LSE, you went back and continued your teaching.
Yes, towards the end of 1964, I'd come to like England. When I first arrived, I thought the place was. I arrived in the middle of winter, and I thought I was going to die of the cold. And I came to the conclusion very quickly. I came to the conclusion very quickly that England wasn't a place fit for human habitation, that people really shouldn't be living there. But by the end of the year, I'd come to like it, and I was if somebody had offered me a job by then, I'd have taken it. In fact, I continued to work as a returned to dentistry, and I worked for 2 or 3 months at the Elephant and Castle, and then a job was advertised at Sydney University, and I applied for it, and I got it, and I went back to a lectureship at the beginning of 1965.
Then you must have done further field work from time to time.
I continued to go back to Manangreeda, for the next 40-45 years, and I've never lost my contact with Manangreeda. From time to time, I thought that I should do what Mervyn Meggett and many others of that generation did, that's to say, establish another field area, and I went to New Guinea for a few months, and I spent 5 months on the east coast of Sri Lanka. But the Sri Lankan beginning may have come to something had it not been for the troubles in the Tamil Tigers and the problems in so-called communal problems in Sri Lanka in the 1970s. So the Sri Lankan research really didn't come to very much, and it was overtaken in 1972 by the arrival of Peter Ucko as the new executive director, or principal as he's called, of the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies. I was much attracted by Peter's vivacity and drive, intellectual sharpness, and so on, and we quickly became good friends. And I spent the next 10 years or so working at the institute in one way or another with Peter, and that meant that I came back to Aboriginal studies full time, really.
What was the main theme of your studies then? Did you continue on conflict, or do you move, as anthropologists do, right through all aspects of Aboriginal
The second, really. I became interested in Aboriginal religion, mythology, symbolism, and so on. By the late 1960s, very much under the stimulus of Levi-Strauss's writings, in the first instance his writing on kinship, but kinship and conflict I already knew about, as it were, and I got into some arguments with Levi-Strauss about some aspects of that. I followed some of his interests in totemism and mythology and so on. And I guess that would be count for most of what I wrote during the 1970s. By the end of the second part of the 1970s. The land rights movement was well and truly underway, I was going to say that I reverted to my earlier interests in kinship and conflict and land ownership and so on, and that is true, but one can't separate land ownership and use from the whole religious panoply and including myths of charter and so on. Mm.
And you got practically involved or legally involved because you were head of a commission, weren't you, and also in...
Well, I never actually did land claim work as many of my colleagues did. I was involved in the first instance mainly as the chairman of the Council of the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies. After the passage of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act 1976, which affected only the Northern Territory, Aboriginal claims began to be lodged, and there was an urgent need for anthropologists to assist in this task. We knew that it wasn't that the land claim process wasn't for eternity. There'd be a cut-off period. There was a limited period in which claims could actually be lodged, and substantiation was needed. In order for the claims to go forward, and there was a dearth of anthropologists who were competent to help in this work, and the Institute played a role, I think a vital role in that early period, in making it possible for anthropologists with the expertise to leave their academic work, their lecturing and so on, and to carry out the work that was necessary. I was invited on one occasion to act as an assistant to the Lands Commissioner, but it happened that I wanted to go on sabbatical leave during that period. So that didn't happen. And then during the 1980s, my hearing began to deteriorate, and so it became impossible for me to participate effectively in court hearings.
You also at some point got, although you said you were not a filmmaker yourself, but you got involved with filmmakers and in a very famous film.
Yeah, well, again, that was Peter Peter Ucko's initiative. He was very keen to develop filmmaking as a major concern of the Institute, and his when he arrived, there was a filmmaker attached to the institute by the name of Roger Sandel. Roger made a number of very fine films for the institute in Central Australia. He left and took up a position in the Sydney department, and Peter then appointed David and Judith McDougall. By the late 1970s, the team had been augmented by the appointment of a young filmmaker by the name of Kim McKenzie, and it was with Kim that my association in the ethnographic films really took place. Kim had come from a film training in Adelaide, and when we met, I guess about 1977-78, I told him that one of my chief mentors at Manangrida had died some years before, and that there was a plan to there was a move to disinter his remains and to ceremonially place them in a hollowed coffin, and that the people were that I had thought that it might be possible to make a film of this, and through my friendship with the younger brother of the deceased man, this was arranged, and we went to Arnhem Land, I think in 1978, and the outcome of that was the film Waiting for Harry, which was Kim's first big film, and I think many would say his best film. It won an RAI award in 1982.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there any topics or themes that you would have liked me to have asked you about, or you'd like to talk about, which I seem to have missed?
We could go on for a long time, but I'm not going to ask you to do that. I think I'd prefer just to say something about the man who became the central figure in the film Waiting for Harry. His name is Frank Germanamana, and it's spelled G-U-R-R-M-A-N-A-M-A-N-A. He taught me Bharata. I began working with him in 1958, and he died last year. I felt that very much as a wrench. I'm sorry. I say that I owe him as much as my anthropological career. I owe as much to him as to anybody else. And just one final note. I decided that I wanted to publish texts that I had received from Frank back in 1960, a series of texts in which he attempted to set out in his own language what he saw as the main institutions of his own society. And I had begun, to some extent, as you began with me, I'd began interviewing Frank, and I'd with a tape recorder, ultimately with a tape recorder, but initially in longhand, and asking him about what do people say to when they bestow a daughter on a man in marriage? What does the mother say? What's the father saying? And that's how it began. By the over a period of some 6 or 8 weeks, in a period in which I'd describe as a burst of creative energy on his part, he began to nominate the topics themselves. I didn't have to ask him the question. He'd come along to the tent one day and he said, "Now today I'm going to tell you about circumcision or death rites and so on." And so I had by the end of it, I had this corpus of texts by a man speaking in his own language about his own culture, and I thought, I want to publish that as a book by Frank Gramanamana. And ultimately, I published not just only a book, but a CD-ROM made by my old friend, the filmmaker Kim McKenzie, who had in effect taught himself to become a CD-ROM maker. And that book is called People of the River Mouth by Frank Gramanamana, and it has inside the pocket, it has the CD-ROM People of the River Mouth. I think that's about all I want to say on that.
Thank you very much indeed, Les. That was a lovely note to end on.